Lives will be lost because we weren't prepared. But right now, I got to solve problems, and I need the federal government to help me.
U.S. states are at odds with Washington on coronavirus response. It's Tuesday, March 24th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Trump spars with China in blame game. New York's Chinatown shuts down. We hear individual stories of new lives at home. The Mekong River has been altered. Robotics for walking. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Global cases of the coronavirus, which causes COVID-19, topped more than 320,000 at the beginning of this week. At the same time, officials identified nearly 30,000 cases in the United States. Governors say the federal government lags far behind in providing the equipment they need to protect their citizens. But Washington says the supply chain is flowing. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
Health experts agree a coronavirus vaccine is at least a year away. Countries now must prepare for an expected surge and strain on their healthcare systems. In the U.S., that preparation comes with a lot of finger-pointing, as states say the federal government is not doing enough, while the federal government says all hands are on deck.
We are shipping from our national stockpile. We're shipping from vendors. We're shipping from donations. It is happening. The demand from the governors is great. The demand around the world is great.
Streets in most cities are empty, and more states each day order citizens to stay at home. Governors say the federal government's help is not coming fast enough.
We are desperate for more PPE equipment, personal protective equipment. We've had a big ask into the strategic stockpile in the White House. They've given us a fraction of our ask, but we need a lot more PPE, both to protect our healthcare workers and to treat the sick.
Lives will be lost because we weren't prepared. But right now, I got to solve problems, and I need the federal government to help me make sure that I've got what we need for our frontline providers in particular, but also ventilators for people that are going to suffer.
In an evening news conference Sunday, President Trump again called it the Chinese virus, but stressed that supplies are en route to states and some already delivered.
We have large quantities of medical equipment and supplies on the way, based on all of this, to those states, including respirators, surgical masks and gowns, face shields, coveralls, and gloves, with large quantities already delivered to Washington and to New York.
The percentage of infected people continues spiking, with global deaths now more than 14,000. The governor of Italy's hardest-hit region says the healthcare system there is pushed to the brink, with 1 in 10 cases affecting health workers. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
These are among some of the top headlines you'll find right now when you make a visit to voanews.com. Japanese Prime Minister raises possibility of postponing 2020 Tokyo Olympics. Pakistan Day postponed in light of coronavirus. India falls silent as it observes 14-hour lockdown. South Korea's coronavirus plan is working. Can the world copy it? Athletic housing in Indonesia turned into emergency coronavirus hospital. You can read and see much more on these stories when you visit VOA Asia Facebook and stop by the voanews.com website. This is VOA Asia. The United States and China have been blaming each other for the spread of the coronavirus, further straining a relationship already stressed by a trade war. President Trump continues to call it the China virus and suggested he was doing so in part because of remarks Chinese officials have made to spread propaganda that the United States may have been responsible for bringing the disease to their country. Patsy Whitaker-Sawara has the story.
As China begins to bring its coronavirus outbreak under control and significantly slow domestically transmitted cases, the Trump administration continues to blame Beijing for not giving other countries enough warning after finding out about the virus late last year. On Friday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged China to share data about the outbreak.
This transparency, this real-time information sharing, isn't about political games.
Despite a United Nations body reminding that virus has no nationality, both Pompeo and President Donald Trump continue to use the term Chinese virus.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China. That's why. It comes from China. I want to be accurate.
Trump said he also used the term to counter Chinese propaganda that the U.S. Army may have been responsible for bringing in the virus, known to be first discovered in Wuhan, China.
When the two countries could and should be cooperating to combat a pandemic, they are instead involved in blame games and arguing about what to call this virus in a way that is, I think, childish and also dangerous in that it distracts both sides from taking care of their people.
China said it is strongly indignant by referrals of the Chinese virus and denied claims that it has not been transparent.
We urge the United States to immediately correct its mistakes and immediately stop its unjustified accusations against China.
The squabble over coronavirus is further testing U.S.-China relationship already stressed by a trade war.
These are the fruits of a headlong rush in Beijing and Washington toward rivalrous relations that's been going on for several years.
And could lead to further problems, particularly at a time when the Trump administration is seeking to find a drug treatment for COVID-19.
Even if we did want to produce the drugs in the United States and we had the capacity to produce them, which we do not, 100% of the reagents or the raw chemicals or building blocks to build these drugs, to make these drugs, come from China.
Also this week, Beijing expelled American journalists in retaliation for Washington reducing the number of Chinese nationals allowed to work for Chinese state media in the U.S. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe announced Monday that his country will require a 14-day quarantine to all visitors from the United States amid an escalating number of coronavirus infections around the globe. Quarantine requirements includes Japanese and American citizens. It goes into effect Thursday until the end of April. You'll find more on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. In Chinese communities across New York City, the local economy has also been hit hard by the outbreak of the coronavirus. Business leaders in Chinatown have called on the government to introduce emergency rescue measures to help Chinese businessmen survive the difficult times. We hear more from Yi Wan in this report, narrated by Tina Trin.
Chin Chen Yuan is a Chinese restaurant located on 8th Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. Since Chinese New Year, business here has been relatively deserted.
Few people come out for dinner at night. We used to be busy at night. But now, we have no business. We just sit there and chat.
The epidemic that has swept across many countries has severely impacted the economy of Chinese communities in New York. Justin Yu, chairman of the Chinese Chamber of Commerce in New York, said that compared with Manhattan's Chinatown, the impact on Brooklyn's 8th Avenue and Flushing's Chinatown in Queens was particularly severe.
Whether it's our supermarkets or restaurants, Chinatowns in Brooklyn and Queens, they have been hit hard.
The Chinese Chamber of Commerce of New York estimates the epidemic has caused losses as high as 50% in major Chinatown industries, such as dining, retail, and tourism. To help keep business going, Justin Yu is suggesting that Chinatown merchants adapt to the new reality.
For example, the number of dine-in meals is way down, but deliveries have increased.
Employees here say they don't have any plans to lay off staff, but if the outbreak intensifies in New York, many may have to reconsider. Tina Trin for Yi Yuan, VOA News, New York.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Pressure is mounting for postponing the Summer Olympics in Tokyo due to the coronavirus pandemic. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said Monday, if it is difficult to hold the Olympics in a complete way, then pushing the event back would be unavoidable in order to protect the safety of athletes. There's more on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. As more people across the United States stay home due to the threat of the coronavirus, they're learning to adapt to a new way of life. VOA's Julie Tabo spoke with a few Washington area residents to see how they're making the best of a scary situation.
Restaurants are empty. So are museums, movie theaters, and other popular places that people tend to gather, all due to the threat of COVID-19. So Washington area residents are preparing to stay closer to home.
Just checking out the grocery store, I try to just take exactly what we need and no more, because got to make sure to leave something for everybody and making the best of what we have.
I don't want to clean out the store, and other people will need things too, so trying to be reasonable about it.
I stocked up and have about 14 days worth of things that I think I would need to support myself if I got ill.
For Henry and Jason Cronick, stocking up on alcohol is also important.
We're buying alcohol in case we get quarantined. And we heard that the Pennsylvania government had closed all the state liquor stores, so we figured the getting's good.
That's good news for liquor store owner Malkit Singh, who says he's noticed an uptick in business lately.
People are working from home. Obviously, they need some reason to be stay happy at home, and they're buying little extra goods.
Ann Hoog is savoring quality time with her family.
Trying to spend the time being outside as much as possible. We've been cooped up all day and inside the house, and so we are coming out to the park.
I'm enjoying spending more time with my pet.
That's Honey, and that's Teddy.
He's just a gorgeous guy, you know what I mean? Just getting him out for some fresh air in the springtime.
I love making cupcakes.
Sophia Panchal is making the best of her time away from school.
So now I'm going to make like an Easter sand of some bunnies, eat some grass.
She decorates cupcakes.
Hi, Abby.
Does FaceTime with her friends and spends time with her sister, Jasmine.
I'm really happy because we get more time to spend with our family. And we've been bike riding down our alleyway. And then we've been doing a lot of crafts and we make cupcakes.
Adults and children alike, despite these trying times, seem to be taking it all in stride.
It's always pleasant to have a martini at the end of a stressful day and think about better times to come, which I'm hoping are around the corner.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
As the coronavirus spreads rapidly and cities move toward possible lockdown, families across the United States are bracing for the worst. VOA's Akibo Islam spent an evening with a family in Great Falls, Virginia.
It's not an ordinary evening at Chotani household as they discuss the importance of practicing everyday preventive actions that can help contain the spread of coronavirus.
What's the important thing, Shamir, that you've got to do in order not to get it?
Wash your hands.
And how do you wash your hands? Vigorously.
Dr. Rashid Chotani is an infectious disease epidemiologist and says that he has been getting his family ready for a pandemic like coronavirus, also known as COVID-19.
50% of the people who will get the disease will be asymptomatic. Social distancing is very important at this point. And what you've got to do is you've got to make sure that you don't expose yourself to unnecessary risk.
Dr. Chitani said before the pandemic ever broke out, his family had a strict rule about hand washing.
We have to wash in between our fingers. One of the things that has been instilled in my family from generations, and specifically my wife, imposes that rule. You have to wash your hands if you're going outside when you come back. Now what we've done is we've pushed that a little bit further and told the kids and instructed them how to really wash your hands in order for you to not contaminate any surfaces.
The entire situation has been a lot on his children.
I really miss going to school, and I just like talking with my friends.
Now that many schools are closed and his family is spending most of the time together, the Chotanis are also practicing social distancing in a way that does not impact their ability to connect.
What really affects me the most is
being able to have physical contact with my loved ones, because we all, as a family, we do share a lot of personal space.
The potential that it could be like almost for the entire year, it's like horrible.
They're also stocking up on food, but only to last a few weeks at a time.
I just want to say that it's good that you can stock some food, but don't hoard it. Share with others also.
The Chotanis are like many American families, preparing for the worst without knowing just how long this public health crisis will last. Saqib al-Islam, VOA News, Great Falls, Virginia.
A message from your friends at VOA Asia. Can the coronavirus survive in cold weather? Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you're sick or advised to by local authorities. A message from your friends at VOA Asia. A series of dams on the transboundary Mekong River has reduced water levels, damaged fisheries, and caused other environmental problems for the people who depend on the waterway for their livelihoods and food. Now, as the latest dam, the Lao-owned Saibury, begins operations on the lower Mekong, a Thai activist group is going to court to slow down the sale of electricity to Thai companies. Steve Sanford speaks to those affected.
Life on the Mekong has changed dramatically in the last 6 months, with increased water shortages following the Saibury Dam's startup. Studies warning about the dam's impact on the river's ecosystem have come true, as fishermen are seeing aquatic habitat disappear and water levels dip. But that's not all.
The water has changed and the color has changed. When the water was natural, it was not clear like this, and it would have sediments and nutrients in there. The water is clear, but the sediments and nutrients have gone.
Now, a Mekong activist group is asking the courts to slow down the Saibury Dam's sale of electricity to a state-owned company until an impact assessment report is made public.
We can't get access to the information and get access to the public hearing event that's organized by the Natural Resources Department that was part of the Mekong River Commission. They can't give us 100% information regarding our concerns.
For farmers like Sinit Kun, who rely heavily on the water for irrigation, the options are drying up.
Because the water is so shallow, it's difficult for the pump to suck the water out, to distribute the water evenly to the rice and corn fields. It has gone down from 100 to 40%.
The Saibury Power Company says it has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to mitigate the negative environmental impacts, including building outlets for sediment passage and flow, and for allowing the passage of fish. Village leader Apinan Utima says the problem can only be resolved by cooperation between affected countries.
We have to find a way how we can live together, because right now the villagers have no choice, don't know what to do anymore, so we only can ask help from the government to be our voice to talk and negotiate between countries.
With the Thai government set to meet with the villagers next month, time will tell what will remain of the river once the dust settles on the future of the Saibury Dam. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Nong Khai, Thailand.
Trexo Robotics is the invention of two passionate robotics engineers who decided they wanted to help those who cannot walk or otherwise move independently. Angelina Bagdasarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
5-year-old Bentley has cerebral palsy. These are the very first steps he has ever made.
Are you walking?
This is amazing to get him moving.
A special robot helps the boy move on his own. These sensors, together with a main mechanism, are attached to the boy's legs, while Bentley relies heavily on a walking frame. The robot is operated through a special app. The exoskeleton was created by two friends, Manmeet Magu and Rahul Udazi. For Magu, the project was born from personal experience when he learned his nephew had cerebral palsy.
My nephew Pranit has cerebral palsy and that he would never be able to walk. We started looking into it and we realized that not walking has so many negative health effects associated with it, and we just wanted to change that. And when we couldn't find any solution for him, we decided to build it ourselves.
Developing the exoskeleton took years. Magu remembers printing out parts for it on his 3D printer at night, often flying to India for a series of fittings for his nephew. It took a long time, but when he saw Pranayit walk for the very first time with the help of the robot, he knew he had won. There are some 700,000 people with cerebral palsy in the US. So once Magu's invention got on the market, thousands of parents lined up to get it in the hopes that it would help their children walk.
The device can be purchased for $29,900, or it can also be leased for $1,000 a month. We've had a kid as young as 11 months old use the device, and someone as old as 25 years old. Right now we have a long waiting list, but we're taking reservations.
For Julio Caro, the robotic support is a true technological miracle.
It's an incredible feeling. I mean, I'm normally 4'11 on my chair, but I'm 6'2 when I'm standing. So it's a great feeling when I'm upright and I'm seeing everybody eye to eye. And it does a lot for you. Like it does, you miss it.
Julio suffered a severe back injury at work 10 years ago and has been wheelchair bound for many years until he found this exoskeleton.
There's a sensor on the left hip of the device, and that sensor can sense his body movement. So as he weight shifts to the left, his right foot steps. As he weight shifts to the right, his left foot steps. And the device is doing that movement for him, but he's in complete control of how he's walking.
In the US, it is possible to get such devices with the help of insurance. The price depends on exoskeleton's complexity. This one costs around $130,000. For Angelina Bogdasarian in Los Angeles, NRI's VOA News.
20,000 years ago, humans lived in grassy tundras near the Arctic Circle. Trees were scarce in these cold, dry regions, so Ice Age hunters could not build campfires using wood. Instead, these hardy humans made campfires by burning the bones of the big animals they hunted. Few modern people know how to make a bone fire. Recently, a Colorado archaeologist and some volunteers gave it a try. Shelley Schlender has more from Longmont, Colorado.
These bones at the Denver Science Museum come from ancient bison. 20,000 years ago, Ice Age people built fires using bones like these from the animals they hunted in cold, dry prairies. They had only grass and twigs from bushes, but no trees, so campfire wood was scarce.
Their alternative fuel clearly was bone, because bone ash shows up in many of the archaeological sites that I have worked at.
Now a team of volunteers helps Hofiker make an Ice Age bone fire, starting with a Paleolithic fire drill.
I am not dreaming that it's going to happen.
We tried a bow drill. That's a lot of work, so we went to our methods with a Bic lighter.
Volunteers feed the fire not big logs, but sticks, similar to the twiggy bushes that Ice Age hunters added to their fires. Then Hofiker adds the main fuel, the bones of a deer carcass cut just hours earlier.
The sizzling sound is mostly that fat burning off, which is appearing to be very flammable.
See if we can reach the ignition temperature of bone, which is high. It's over 350 degrees centigrade. It's much higher than wood, so it looks like maybe we're getting there.
Ice Age hunters used mostly bones, but when Hofiker adds more bones, flames turn to smoke. They save the fire by going back to sticks.
So we're feeding it here. We're feeding it like mad.
The fire gets hot enough for grilling steaks, and the team eats them Paleolithic style.
There's something supremely satisfying about eating meat with your hands. It's just freshly cooked.
That's when people start to notice a change in the fire.
This is lasting way longer than a wood fire.
The majority of the fires going off of the animal fats and the marrows that are dripping through there. I think most of the wood's been consumed at this point.
Yeah, the thing is we've hardly fed this at all for like the last, 30 minutes. Yeah. Some of the bone is burning, yes.
Hofiker plans to try more bone fires to better understand the Ice Age humans who lived in cold, dry places 20,000 years ago. Shelley Schlender, VOA News, Longmont, Colorado.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our accounts on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. No matter how you've listened to our program today, we thank you for joining us. We also thank Managing Editor Diane Gao and our VOA Asia team. That's Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you enjoy the day, and we hope you're safe and well.